On this week's episode of The Freenoter, we'll look at the problem of the problem, how what you think you're solving may not be what the audience wants.
We'll look at the work of Hall of Fame speaker Jay Baer and how he uses research to shape those problem statements.
And we'll visit New Orleans for the original cocktail, the Sazerac.
Which will solve all your problems.
It should.
It should. All this and more on this week's episode of The Freenoter. So what are we talking about this week?
We're talking about problems.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And, you know, in the mo money, mo problems, and that's very true for freenoters. The mo problems the audience has, the mo money we could make.
That's right. I mean, the good news is there's really an infinite number of problems. I mean, there's an infinite number of questions that people have, actively have. That's a key point. That you as a freenoter and the product or service that you represent can help solve. And I think the real key for being a great freenoter is making that connection between the two.
Yeah. And I think in my early days as a freenoter, let's say I was a mediocre freenoter, the problem that I wanted to solve was, you haven't bought my stuff yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know that they need my stuff.
Right.
Right. And that's not a problem that the audience thinks they have or knows they have.
Would even acknowledge that they have. And that's a key problem, because like the first problem you have to solve as a freenoter is gaining the audience's attention and agreement in the first place. And that starts with the organizer. So we've talked on previous episodes about how to write the description in such a way. But we even then were talking about it has to be anchored in a question that the audience has right now, not the question that you wish they had, or you know what the real question actually is. So I know when I'm working with clients a lot, we have this conversation and I will often say, well, what is a question that the audience is asking right now that your product or service will help them solve? And they'll come back with a question that could only be asked by somebody who already knows about the solution. And that isn't what people are asking right now. That's the question you wish they were asking, but that's not the question they're actually asking. So it's a real key, I think, to really do the work to either think about or to find out, which brings us to research and what you do. What are some of the questions that people are asking right now? Because you have to start there in order to lay a path that the audience will follow from where they are right now to where you want them to be. And that's your job as a freenoter, is to move them along that path.
And we've talked in a previous episode about why talks, what now talks, and how talks. And they really run the gamut on what the audience's problem is. And you know, if I give a breakout session at a marketing conference and it's 10 ways to write better survey questionnaires, that's exactly the problem that the audience has if they attend that talk. They're self-selecting to that.
Correct. Yeah.
But when you're doing a sort of a what now talk, right? And in my case, those what now talks are often about encouraging people to find other ways to solicit customer feedback. They may come in with one problem, and the problem that they know they have might be, you know, might be declining customer satisfaction scores. It might be slipping market share or something like that. That's the problem that they know they have. And I may think that my solution can solve for that, but it's not necessarily what they're looking for, right?
Right.
They're looking for a different thing.
That's right. And that's a huge piece, because, you know, one of the kind of central tenets of my work is that, you know, how we see drives what we do, right? Which means you can't change what people do until you change how they see. And so this means if we're thinking about the audience and we're thinking about the questions they're asking as they're walking into the room where we're going to give this free note, we have to start from their perspective. We have to start the whole presentation from the perspective they currently have, which means we have to have done the work to actually understand what that perspective is. Because in order for them to come to our perspective, we have to understand what's required and what the most likely avenues are and what the easiest levers are going to be to push to shift that perspective. I mean, because just think about it. I mean, I know the tendency is to just walk in and say, well, you should have this perspective. Like, and that's the mistake, right? To walk in and say, this is the solution and this is the problem. And you didn't even know you had this problem, but trust me, this is the solution. I think stylistically, some people could get away with that. But the way that the humans are wired, like 100% of humans are wired, that if you tell somebody what the answer is, they're going to immediately reject it. And so, you know, given the fact that your job as a freenoter is to get that opening to the next step, I'm of the opinion that you want to do everything possible to avoid that resistance, that reactance, as it's technically known, to somebody listening. And so to me, that really means starting with kind of a radically empathic understanding of where somebody is right now.
I spoke at a conference last week that was about voice technology, right? The Alexas and Hey Googles and things like that of the world. And I saw a really good example of somebody who gave a pretty good talk, but they hadn't really sussed out the audience's problem that well. And it was a keynote, and it was from, I'll just say, one of the leading players in the space. And they spent 45 minutes talking about all of their new innovations. And I believe that they were, as you would say, smart, capable, and good, because they were talking to an audience of developers who develop for not just that company, but others.
Yep.
And I believe that their intentions were good. Like, here are all the great things that we are doing in the space. And at the end of that, even though at no point did the speaker say, and you should buy this, or you should, you know, like, there wasn't necessarily a call to action, it was in fact a talk without a problem.
Mm.
And I was left, you know, and I hate to criticize other speakers, because I think, you know, the speaker was gave a good performance.
Well, it sounds like a missed opportunity.
It was a missed opportunity to really just go one level deeper into thinking about what kinds of problems would it was a lot of developers. What kind of problem does a developer know that they have, right? This is someone who's working in like 2-week sprints to accomplish a very specific thing.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons why I separate, when I'm working with folks on kind of creating the backbone of the case for their idea, why I separate what I call the goal from the problem. Mm. And the goal is what the audience walks in wanting. And sometimes that is in fact a solution to a known problem. But I think to your point about a missed opportunity there, it's that when you're freenoting, yeah, you really do have a choice about whether you're not just going to inform somebody so that the outcome is understanding, or are you trying to actually do something with that time? And that's the action piece. And I think if you really are looking for getting someone to act, then they're more likely to act when you have created some kind of motivation for action. And I have found over and over again that the best motivation for action is to create a gap between what somebody knows they want and what they understand, and then something what they want to know about. But that's a very tricky thing, right? And that's where I think the really powerful talks, whether it's a freenote or a keynote or whatever, absolutely starts the talk with something that the audience knows they want, even if that's a problem that they know they have. So I call that the goal. But then you introduce a problem that they didn't know they had. That's the real reason why that goal, that why they've been struggling to achieve that goal in the first place. And that real problem, I think, is where a great speaker, freenoter or not, can really start to set themselves apart, because that's where you start to differentiate you and your company and your product and service based on the perspective and the point of view and the thinking, because you're able to set up a contrast between how most people think about that particular goal or that problem that people know about and how you think about it. And there's huge opportunity there for differentiation and curiosity, all those things that get people to engage on their own in your talk and want you and give you permission to keep going and give you permission to tell them more.
All right. So you've just brought up a very sticky wicket, I think. Very sticky wicket.
Oh, look at that croquet reference.
Fantastic, right?
Right.
So, I mean, what you are proposing here, I mean, the easiest way to give a talk to an audience is to address the problem that they explicitly would state that they have, right?
Yeah.
They come to your talk, I would like 10 great tips on how to write better emails. And you have a talk entitled 10 great tips on how to write better emails.
Right.
And you deliver those 10 great tips, you're going to get a good score.
You are. And they're going to love it. And they're going to remember none of it.
Right. Absolutely none of it.
None of it. Right. Because yes.
Yeah. Yep. But there's a big leap between, you know, someone coming into your talk saying, you know, 10 great ways to improve your emails. And I have to admit, I have done this. I have given a talk I actually gave a workshop that got very bad scores, and I didn't handle this well. It was I gave a long workshop, and it was meant to be to tech executives and developers, and they wanted to understand how to market their products a little bit better. And I went in and I gave what I knew they needed. I gave them the cod liver oil that was the, you know, and the spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down. And I knew that they needed it. And when I
it doesn't sound like there was any sugar, and that's the problem.
I've always got some sugar.
But you see what I'm saying? It's like people will listen to information that they would not have listened to originally if they believe that you understand their current point of view and you have validated why they're doing what they're doing now first. Like you have to, they have to believe that you understand and respect what they've been doing so far. Because if you go in there and say, well, that's just stupid that you did it this way, or like, oh, I can't believe you were thinking that, or like, you think that's the problem, but the real problem is this. Who likes to listen to that? Very few people. And so, I mean, I think that what happens when that happens is you go in saying, well, I know better. You go in with a kind of a superior, you know, positioning to your audience. It's one of the reasons why I really don't like some of the advice that's out there that says that you are the guide or the mentor on your customer, the hero's journey. No, you are a fellow traveler at best. And in fact, I think the best role for you as a speaker is actually as the kind of omniscient narrator behind the scenes, as you know, giving information so that the audience, the hero, can really come to these realizations on their own. And occasionally you're summing them up for them, but not in a position of a superiority, which obviously is a challenge if you're trying to introduce a perspective on a problem that they haven't currently had. But I think that there's ways to do that have really worked. So that was something that didn't work for you.
Yeah.
When, you know, what has been successful for you when you feel like you have introduced a problem, you know, that was what, you know, the one that they really needed to solve. What was successful for you about introducing that?
Well, what was successful for me was putting in a step that I missed. And when I gave this workshop, it was, you know, again, it was a workshop for tech executives, and it was this, you know, they'd signed up for like 3.5 hours to listen to me talk, which, you know,
I do every day, baby.
They should get the Croix de Webster for that, some kind of.
Oh, I've award. Got like Hall of Fame then.
Then you are. 100% Hall of Fame. And, you know, they wanted to know, how can we market our software better? And they had an expectation, I think, of I'm going to give them marketing techniques to push their message out. And I didn't do that. Instead, I said, the problem is you don't know your audience well enough, and you haven't done enough work on what their actual problems are. And I believe to my gut that it was correct, but what, you know, but they wanted something to walk out with that was like, here's how to fix my email. And I missed a step. And that step that I missed was the work of reframing the problem. Mm. And you just hit on it, right? And, you know, you and I live in downtown Boston, and everywhere we walk downtown, you'll see missionaries with pamphlets like, you know, how to get out of debt, how to talk to your children better. And those problem statements hook you in. The answer, of course, is salvation.
that particular faith or whatever.
And that particular faith, right? But that's not dissimilar to what a freenoter has to do. So the question is, how do you reframe a problem statement to the problem, from the problem that they think they have to the problem that you know they have, in a way that they will accept? And right. And you have a way of doing that.
Yeah. And before I'll get there, though, let me, if I may, explain what the thing is that we have to get past originally. And I kind of referenced it obliquely, but you reminded me a little while ago of a concept of mine that you really enjoyed, which is something I call the no hole.
I love the no hole. Yeah.
Which is this idea that between where somebody is and where you want them to be is this big yawning chasm of no. You know, they're like, you're like, come on over here. And they're like, nope. And that you have to do the work to kind of build a way to cross that chasm so that they say yes. And so the thing is that you can, in fact, kind of do this. It's not a bait and switch, but you can kind of pause and redirect people in a talk or in a workshop where you say, I will answer this question for you, But first, there is actually, in fact, something based on my experience that's important that we talk about first. May I do that? And when you do that, you get that permission for them to go, well, okay, because you've told them that you will still give them the answer. Now, the deal is you actually do have to give them the answer. You do have to tell them how to market. But you have to, that allows you sometimes, if you really have to make a really sharp detour before you can give them what they're looking for, to say, would it be okay? Will you go with me while I do this segue into something else? And I think that's really key, because the thing with the no hole is that there's no coming back from it.
Yeah.
Like once you've introduced a no, or once they've introduced it, once you've introduced something to which they go, nope, that's not what I want. That's not what I asked for. That's not what I believe. You really have pretty much lost them, or you need to consider that you have. So that when you put these kind of steps in your talk together, starting with knowing that really early on, they have to hear something that they know that they want. You have to give them that, you know, that you're going to give them something that they want. That's a goal or a problem that they know they want solved, or a need that's going unmet. The next step is this kind of, okay, well, what's been getting in the way of that? And you have to make sure that you're presenting that real problem, quote unquote, real problem, in a way that they will still say yes to, which means you can't make them feel stupid or incapable or dumb or wrong for having done that in the first place. So yeah, that's all a way of saying that what I try to do when I'm trying to revealing the real problem is finding something about how they're looking at the problem now that I actually agree with. Right. And so one of my favorite examples for this is a client of mine. She's a woman named Tracy Tim, and she works with both companies and young millennial career women on kind of what they want to do with their lives. And, you know, when she and I were working together on a talk that she wanted to give to, you know, organizations, we had to figure out how to frame her solution, which was, you know, how do you retain more millennial employees? So we started with the question that these folks had right now, which is like, what is it these people will actually accept as a reason to stay in our company? Right. But that was a question they were asking. Yeah. And so we framed it as, you know, what are the new levers of loyalty? Because clearly there are some, the old stuff isn't working, whatever. And so that was the problem they knew they had. We don't know how to retain these folks. How do we retain them? And she needed to go in and say, I'm going to give you that answer. Now, the next step is to say, okay, so let's look at the situation a little bit and let's understand why this is such a hard question. You know, why the old levers aren't working. And the way that we looked at it, say, okay, well, what is, you know, what's part of how they're looking at the situation right now that we agree with? And part of it was that they were really, you know, that, you know, incentives and stuff are focused on positions that people are in. You know, that based on what level you're in the organization, you get certain benefits or perks or whatever. And so what we needed to do, so we knew that they would agree with that. If we said, so part of the problem is that, you know, there's something about the positions, right? Yes. Okay. But what we need to do is introduce something about that perspective that was new, but they would also agree with. And this is the key in my mind to finding a real problem that people accept, even though it's not what they expect. And so what we did was we said, well, you know, where Tracy's answer comes in, it was really looking at what the people in those positions actually want. So we kind of created what I like to call this problem pair between the current focus, positions, and this, and the kind of new focus, which was people in those positions. And with the kind of simple reason that we knew that the people we were talking to would agree that, like, it's the people that make the positions work. So if we could do that, if we could come up with kind of a way to frame the problem that they would agree with, then we knew we could kind of introduce a new solution, which for her was ultimately to tailor the incentives to the person in a position. In other words, don't ignore position-based incentives, but give options so that people could individualize those packages based on the level, on who they were and the levels that they were.
So when I worked on revising my sort of, you know, high-level what now you need market research talk, I lurked in the back room of one of your, Red Thread workshops, actually.
That's right.
And I worked on it. And one thing I sort of discovered about doing this, you know, I settled on a goal that I knew that the audience would have, which a lot of my clients have, which is how do we differentiate our product or service in a landscape where everything sounds the same to people? And I developed a problem pair, as you call it, you know, the problem that, you know, you think it's this, but actually it's this. And I think the gentlest way to do that is the you think it's this part is something that, you know, they may not 100% agree with right out of the gate, but it would be hard to disagree with.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's a slight adjustment on that phrasing is not just you think it's this, but it's actually this. It's you think it's this. Would you agree it could also be this?
Yes.
And that's the key, because the mental image that I always come to mind when I do this, and when I talk about it, I present a very old optical illusion, which I like to refer to as the duck bunny, which is, you know, it's depending on how you look at it, it's either like a rabbit or a duck. I mean, it's very
it's a duck.
It's a bunny. But people have probably seen the old woman, young woman, or the two people, or the vase kind of thing. But that's the mental image that I think is really useful here to think about what we're trying to achieve when we come up with a problem pair like this, which is to say what somebody is looking at is not wrong.
Yeah.
But their focus on, let's say, the duck is keeping them from being able to see the bunny. And what we're trying to do is find something that they can agree is also there.
100%. And I'll just share the kind of problem pair that I came up with lurking in the back room. You know, you think your problem is that you need to be a megaphone out into the world for your product or service. It's also true, however, that your job is to be a bullhorn for your customers back into the organization. And that was a reframing that suited me. And it's also not something that someone would say, no, we don't do that. No one's going to say that. It is part of your job as a marketer. And so it's not like I was saying, you know, you think the problem is that you need to lose weight, but actually the problem is you need more milkshakes. Like that, I didn't do that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But that reframing worked really, really well for me, because it was not something you would disagree with. And it was something that would make you not, it wouldn't lead you into the no hole. It would make you curious, I hope.
Right. Because I mean, that's the key, is that you have to confirm
yes.
what people are already thinking. And you have to find a new path within how they already look at the world, which means you have to do that work of figuring out what that is. Now, I know I get this question a lot when I'm, you know, doing workshops on this, or even working with clients, or folks who are saying, well, how much research and where do I get that research on what actually either what is it that they know they have, or how is it that they're looking at the world right now, or what would be successful? And I know based on the kind of scrappy places that I've had to be as a marketer, that there's some back of the envelope ways to do that. I often will tell people to, you know, look for the search strings that are bringing people to their site, or talk to their frontline people just to get what are the questions that people are asking, or what are some of the angles that people find effective. You can even go to something like answerthepublic.com and see what are common search strings around a particular word, so that you can at least justify to yourself that, okay, actually, no, nobody is in fact asking the question the way that you wish they were. But since you're a researcher, I'm curious, like, what's your perspective on, you know, what's safe? How do people discover that? If they don't do it before, when should they do it? Like, what are some kind of I'm curious. It's like, what's the range of options that can come into play when someone's like, I don't even know where to start to find either not only the problem they know they have, but the problem they don't know they have. Like, what's your perspective?
That is a great, great point, because we talked earlier about the audience and doing research into the audience, and that's talking to meeting planners and talking to the people that are actually going to be at the event. But to really get down to actually making a difference for these people, you have to research the people that they serve.
That's
really the only true source of competitive advantage there is to do your own work, to do your own kind of primary research. So, you know, if you're researching people who write, you know, if you're giving a talk to people who provide software to the financial services industry, you know, step one of researching an audience is to talk to that meeting planner and maybe talk to some of the people in the audience. Step two, who do they serve? Okay, they serve independent financial planners. They serve wealth managers at mid-sized banks. Well, what's their problem? What do they think is the problem? And if you can provide those answers, But also see the problem from their perspective as well. That's when you're adding real value to what you are delivering in this talk.
Yeah.
And that brings us to our real hero of speaking this week, because I have a great story about him, and I know you do too.
Yeah.
And that is Hall of Fame speaker Jay Baer, legitimate, legitimate National Speaking Association Hall of Fame speaker. Jay Baer, good friend of ours, extremely gifted and intelligent speaker on marketing and customer service and things like that.
Who 100% started as a freenoter, by the
100%.
Way.
100%. At 100% a freenoter.
Yep.
I toiled in those
he
trenches.
He is 100% not a freenoter now, so you don't get Jay for free, and nor should you, because he brings such value to any event. I mean, he really does. And he's a master at matching the kind of level of tactical need of the audience to what he has. I mean, he can speak about any of his topics at any of those levels. And that's one of the things I find so impressive about him.
Well, there are many people that I know and like and find funny. I have a short list of people that I really respect. And Jay is on that list. And if you're thinking about, if you're hiring a speaker about customer service or marketing, and you're thinking, why should I invest in someone like Jay? It's because he's already invested in you, already done so. And I can give you a great example of that. So his most recent book is Talk Triggers. Before that, he had a book called Hug Your Haters. And he wanted to do some research on expectations of customer service in various channels. And he had a thesis about that. And he came to me, and we did some consumer research. Again, we researched the people that the people he was speaking to wanted to know about. And what we discovered was it did not support his thesis. We discovered something else.
Wow. Yeah.
And to Jay's endless, endless, endless credit in my book, because I don't get that enough, he was like, all right, this is what's true. This is not what I thought, but this is what is true. And so this is what I'm going to write about. And that research informed a lot of Hug Your Haters. And so he didn't go into it trying to shoehorn his vision of the problem. He had a thesis about it. The thesis was not proven, but we saw something else that was immensely valuable. And then Jay took it and ran with it.
Right.
He did the work.
And that was one of the fun things that, because he came to me after he came to you and said, okay, let's tighten this up and make sure that it's as strong as it can be. And one of the things that we really worked on was actually this, what we call a problem statement, which is this encapsulation of the real problem. And really what he found as a result of your work was something that, together he and I turned into, I think, what's in many ways one of the signature phrases of that book and that talk. And you can hear both sides of the problem pair here, that, haters aren't your problem, ignoring them is. So even though the phrasing of that makes it sound like, oh, haters aren't your problem, they actually are, right? Because that's what's that, people are walking in the front door of that talk saying, like, how do we deal with like negative press online? And he's able to say, listen, yes, those people exist, but here's why ignoring them is such a problem. And ignoring them is such a problem because of the results of the research that you found, which is that the people who were the haters were often, right, some of the most passionate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
There were onstage haters and offstage haters, which was a lovely distinction.
Yeah.
So absolutely check out Jay's work. We'll have some links in the show notes. And I think it's that time.
I think it is that time. One other quick thing before we go to that is that, this idea of the problem pair is probably something that you and I could spend a whole other show on right now. But I did write about it a little bit, so I don't know if we want to include that in the show notes as well. Just a way to kind of start to think about the problem pair.
Yes.
And really the way to think about it is, usually in terms of relationships, the one that it almost never is it's not X, it's Y.
Yeah.
It's something like, you think it's X, but actually Y comes first. Or if you look at X, it's a whole bunch of Ys. Or, X is really just, one big Y or something like that. That might be helpful.
You know what's really helpful?
Delicious alcohol.
A Sazerac. really quickly, we've been enjoying a wonderful cocktail tonight, and this is this week's Pellet, the reward you get for navigating the maze and pushing the lever of listening to our show.
Yes.
And the Sazerac is the first cocktail. It is the first cocktail.
Which makes me wonder, like, why did they feel compelled to make it, though?
Interesting story. Okay. So the Sazerac was invented by Antoine Peychaud.
Oh, of the bitters.
Of the bitters. He made the bitters. And basically he took, at the time, this was a long time ago in New Orleans, he took a French cognac, basically, a kicked up brandy, and mixed his bitters in it and served it in a sort of an egg-shaped cup that was called a cocktail.
Ah.
Yes, there you go.
Which those, like, uneducated folks that were traipsing into the hotel or whatever were like, cocktail? Cocktail?
Cocktail twins? Exactly.
So it's a bastardization of what they heard.
Exactly. And it's the first cocktail. And we don't make it with cognac anymore because cognac is either really expensive or gives you a skull drilling.
And we're freenoters.
So we've made it the new traditional way, which is with rye. This is a great cocktail, especially, if, you know, it's a very simple cocktail to make at home. You take 2 ounces of rye. We've used Templeton tonight. 4 dashes of Peychaud's bitters. Still make them today. Antoine died. 4 dashes of Peychaud's, 2 dashes of Angostura bitters, and a teaspoon of simple syrup. And stir that over ice a little bit. Leave it in the glass. Leave it in the shaker, sorry. And then take another glass, chilled, hopefully, and put just like a teaspoon of absinthe in it. And we have had a bottle of absinthe here for like 7 years. It'll last you forever. Yep. Because you put a teaspoon in it, you roll it all around the glass, and then you dump it out. You just want to basically rinse the glass, and then you strain the rest of the cocktail into it, put a lemon twist, and enjoy it. And it's the first cocktail. It's a real taste of New Orleans. Yeah.
What do you love about it?
I love the fact that the absinthe gives an incredible herbaceous character to it without the actual necessary taste of absinthe. And because absinthe can be very high alcohol. The one that we have is like 151 proof. There's almost none of it in there.
That's not possible. 151 proof?
Of course it's possible.
Is it possible?
Yeah. You never heard of Bacardi 151?
Is that what that means?
Uh-huh.
Oh, see, I'm just doing my math wrong. This is why you do the math.
This is why I do the math. Yeah. The proof is double the percentage of alcohol. So.
Got it. All right. See, I thought it was the other way around, at which point we would have been like really drunk. So.
And we're not.
We're not.
We have enjoyed a Sazerac, but it is the end of the show. Let's talk about next week. On next week's episode of The Freenoter, we'll talk about a very deep topic, and that's performance. How do you deliver a great talk?
We're going to look at the incredible work of a woman named Eva Kaur and how her content trumps performance. One of my favorite examples from a company I used to work with.
Fantastic. And we'll keep our performance fresh, especially for dry January, if you're doing that, with a deliciously adult and yet non-alcoholic cocktail.
Which is delicious. It really is.
It really is.
All this and more on the next episode of The Freenoter.
Cheers.
Cheers.